In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, very lesser and uncommon. Daran sam chen tam che lo che su drawers and ji lap to soul, chalam bu drawers and ji lap to soul, am chalpa sellers and ji lap to soul, chalpa yeshe su chawers and ji lap to soul. I pray for blessing may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing may confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dam lu dam nu chen ke chulvum da da mi ke nam dang jo a kun chi da ke ji tsam par tam chi ke du da ki chu ten to. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And we will chant together, or you can just listen to the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So it always brings us, it leaves us at verse one of the 37 practices. All right, so now we will begin our meditation, the two wings of awakening, cultivating wisdom and compassion. So let's begin, as always, by just checking in with our posture. You may have already done that, but if you haven't, just check in and make sure that your body is basically in straight alignment. Your spine is basically straight and your shoulders are squared. Your feet are on the ground, on the floor, parallel to each other. Your hands are in a stable position and your gaze is in a stable position. And you can do this meditation with eyes slightly open, as we generally do, or closed, whichever is more comfortable. And that said, also make sure that your body is relaxed. And we will begin, as we often do, with a brief body scan, helping to bring our attention from being in our thoughts to being in our body and the actual physical feeling of being in this moment. So however you want to do that, you can do a body scan from head to toe, or you can just have a general sense of your whole body, but it should be a very physical felt sense of being physically present on your seat, in the space that you're in, also in this cyberspace, very grounded. And within this grounded, aware, relaxed state of mind and body, we contemplate the four reminders that turn our minds to the Dharma as the first of the four Dharmas of Gampopa hopes we will do. The first one is appreciating our precious human existence. That is also the first verse, the first practice of a bodhisattva, to appreciate that we have this boat that can carry us all the way to the other shore, to the awakening of a Buddha. So we need to get in the boat, as Ken MacLeod says, and go. Really resolving to do that, if that's what we want to do. And then remembering that it's an urgent situation because of impermanence and death. You know, we will definitely die at some point, and we don't know how much time we have, so we can't put it off. And anything can happen at any moment. You know, the phone call, the diagnosis, our situation can change so that we don't have the opportunity to practice Dharma. So this is the time to do it. Third, what's called the law of karma, of cause and result, remembering that we create our future through our actions in the present. So if we engage in actions that cause harm to others, we will have suffering in the future, in this lifetime and other lifetimes. If we are careful to refrain from harm and we engage only in actions that help others, we're creating a situation of happiness for ourselves in the future. And if we engage in Dharma practice and remember the Dharma, to whatever extent we're able to do that, to that extent we are sowing the seeds for ultimate liberation, for freedom of mind. And then the fourth thought, that there's no point in trying to get a better samsara. The teachers all assure us that it can't be done. Not that we don't do what we can to make things better for any individual, anyone in the present moment, but ultimately we need to free ourselves from samsara and also help others to free themselves beyond any other help that we may give them. So now we can just follow the breath for a few moments. Again, not losing that sense of physical presence in this present moment. And keeping our awareness very open, as limitless as we can tune into, but using a small part of our attention to follow the breath, to keep our awareness anchored. So now we will segue from that into within this state of meditation, of resting the mind, and you could even keep following the breath if you wish to. Just relate to everything we're experiencing in this present moment as if it were a dream, with the possibility that it could be, in some sense, a dream. At the very least, our reality won't be the same moments from now, a week from now, a year from now. Letting go of relating to things in a solid way, especially our own thoughts, opinions, judgments, and so forth. Already we can feel more freedom of mind. Maybe things aren't exactly the way we think that they are. Just letting go of all that weight. Taking our experience as lightly as if it were a dream that we were going to wake up from. And then, without a need to lose that thread, we can turn our attention inward even within knowing that our experience is like a dream, we can look inward at our mind, at our awareness, examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn, and see who it is or what it is that's experiencing our life as a dream in this present moment. And if we can find any characteristics to it, any color, shape, or location, we can rest in that. And if we don't, then we just rest in freedom from all of those things. Just looking, not analyzing, looking and resting, as you might observe a flock of birds or a butterfly. Then letting even the remedy release naturally of its own accord, meaning any conclusions we've come to about our experience or the nature of our mind, we just let go of all those thoughts. And that brings us to rest in the essence, the basis of everything, our Buddha nature, our nature of mind, without analyzing it, without thinking we've got it or we don't have it, just rest. Taking this resting state just as lightly as we took our experience of a dream. Not worrying about whether we're resting correctly or not correctly, but just resting. As any judgment or thought may come up, we just let go of it and come back to rest in complete freedom. And that is how we cultivate the wing of wisdom, seeing things as they really are, resting in the true nature of everything, including our own mind. And without losing track of that, we can practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath, starting out by just, again, letting some of our attention rest on our breath, becoming aware of our inhalations and our exhalations, however they're occurring. And now bringing someone to mind, anyone, individual, person, group of people, class of people, an animal or group of animals that we know is suffering. And wishing for them not to suffer, wishing in a heartfelt way for them not to suffer. So first developing that wish, even as we remain aware of our breath coming and going. And not only do we wish wholeheartedly for them not to suffer, we also wish for them to be filled with happiness and even awakening. And we actualize those two wishes by coordinating them with the breath, breathing in the suffering, thinking we're really taking it away from this person or animal or group of people or animals. Breathing that suffering right into our heart center, into our limitless Buddha nature. Letting it dissolve naturally. Breathing out happiness to them, peace, relaxation, the antidote to whatever is making them suffer. And we'll continue this for a minute or so. Thinking that we're really accomplishing it just through our intention. Doesn't have to be a tight focus If other people or animals come to mind, that's fine too. They can be there too. Continuing to breathe in their suffering and free them from it. Letting it dissolve, breathing out happiness and relief. And now expanding that visualization to include anyone who has the same kind of suffering. Or perhaps to include people that we don't know very well, that we just encounter in passing and don't really have a concept of as people. Wishing the same for them in a very heartfelt way. Breathing in their suffering. Breathing out happiness, peace, health. Whatever they need. And we're really focusing here on the feeling in our heart of this process happening and not so much on the thought that we're generating about it. And now expanding our visualization and intention even further to include all sentient beings, humans, animals, gods and not gods, hungry ghosts, all beings, whether we can visualize them or not, just knowing that space is filled with sentient beings who are suffering. Not worrying about whether we're really accomplishing it or not, but allowing the space that we might be having an effect just through our positive aspirations. Now, thinking that all beings, including ourselves, are completely free from all suffering, completely filled with happiness, and completely awake. And then letting go of all visualization and all thoughts and concepts, just resting again. And the essence, the basis of everything, our own Buddha nature. However it is. And now taking a moment to just come back to our ordinary state of mind. If you can stay in touch with wisdom and compassion, with awareness and with even taking and sending as we're studying and contemplating, that's great. Or coming back to it whenever there's a gap of space. So welcome, Fanny. And I saw your messages, and please feel free to send us a message anytime. So Marilyn and Patrick are in transit today, so they won't be with us. And Chet is going to be late, and somebody else could. Oh, Mark couldn't be here because he had some work that he had to finish. I'm glad everybody's here who's here. So today we are going to be studying verse 7. Practice 7 of the 37 practices of a bodhisattva, which is to rely on refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or to seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so we'll be talking about that today, exploring that today. So I don't know if everybody had a chance to look at the contemplation, at the what I posted for verse 7, the preliminary post, which has the usual silent pop quiz. Just taking a moment to bring to mind what the practices are that we've studied so far. Practice 1, practice 2, practice 3, practice 4, practice 5, and practice 6. And if you couldn't come up with the list, no problem, but it's a good aspiration to have. To know what it is we're continuously practicing, because it's not like we finish one and go on to the next one. It's like we explore one and we carry it forward, and then the next one is added to our practice, because the 37 practices of a bodhisattva is a continuous and all-inclusive enterprise. Throughout the 37 practices, we will always be studying, contemplating, and meditating, leaving our homeland, relying on solitude and silence, letting go of attachment to this lifetime, not following friends who harm our practice, negative friends, friends who have a negative influence on us and distract us. And that's the disentanglement. First one, again, is just setting the stage. Like, this is what we're going to be doing from now until the end of our lives and beyond, hopefully, is practicing the Dharma through study, contemplation, and meditation. And then the next four verses, that would be 2, 3, 4, and 5, are disentanglement, like renunciation. It's how we... how we bring ourselves to stop believing that anything in our samsaric experience is going to bring us lasting happiness, lasting authentic happiness. That's what renunciation means. That's what disentanglement means. We're sort of cutting the ties to our belief that these things will bring us happiness. So those things are our habitual reactions to things, you know, our involvement in, you know, our friendships and our enmities, or zoning out through denial, giving up our belief that that's going to lead us to anything good, indulging in angry responses or desire for things, or zoning out to just not wanting to know things. Those will not ever lead us to happiness, is the Buddha's teaching. So that's the second practice of a bodhisattva. The third one, to rely on solitude, means that our distraction and our busyness, like whatever we're involved in that keeps us too busy to practice or too distracted to practice, those things are not going to bring us happiness. It's not that we have to give up our activities and even give up our distractions, but we have to understand very thoroughly that the happiness, whatever happiness we feel or fulfillment we feel through doing those things, is not the ultimate happiness. The ultimate happiness, the happiness which lasts, the happiness that's resilient, peace of mind that's resilient, is somewhere else, which is what we're stepping into today. And then the fourth one, to let go of attachment to this life. So we're entangled with so many things in this life. Love for our friends and attachment to our material possessions to one degree or another. Attachment to being alive in this body. We don't want to die. But none of those things, even if we never died, we would not be happy. We could be 250 years old and we still wouldn't have lasting happiness. So that's not it. And we're going to be exploring that through the commentaries today. Like, that's not it either. And then the last one of the disentanglements is our friends. We're very attached to our friends, but some of them may not lead us in a positive direction. And in order to fully practice the Dharma, we have to recognize that and cut through those influences. Not turn on the people, but just not let them lead us astray, lead us away from what really will lead us to happiness. So that's the disentanglement. So then with verse 6, we turn towards the path. We're still in the preliminaries, but we're turning towards the path now because we know how to disengage ourselves now from believing that there is happiness to be found in samsara. And so we turn towards the path first by connecting with spiritual friends. And we've learned from several of the commentaries that that means both a teacher, we need a teacher, an authentic teacher, as Gampopa says, we can't travel the path without. And it's also helpful to have a spiritual community, even one or two people who have the same aspirations that we do and can sort of reinforce us in that direction. That leads us toward lasting happiness and away from the suffering of samsara. And today we arrive at verse 7, the last of the preliminary practices. This is class number 10, and we have now completed, today we'll complete the preliminary practices, the preparation for the path. And that is to seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So does anybody have any comments before we chant the verses? Actually, we need to discuss that, but does anybody have anything they'd like to say? So we have two choices, and I'm going to do a screen share now with the verses. So this text is only going to get longer, and class is a limited amount of time. So I'm going to suggest at this point that we might, rather than chant all of the verses that we've covered together, we might just chant together the name of the practice, and then just chant three times the verse we're on. If we have time left over at the end of the class, which could happen sometime, then we could chant all the verses and do some meditation on them. So does anyone feel that they would rather chant all of the verses rather than just focus on the last one? I can't see all of you, so you'd have to unmute yourself to say.
Lama?
Yes, Namdak.
I think if we chanted all verses, if we continued doing that over the course of several weeks, it would get kind of long. I like the idea of chanting the title of each verse and then going on to the current verse.
Okay, anyone object? Then we're going to try that today. We'll see how it goes, and feedback is always welcome. So, starting with verse 1, and I'll scroll up as we need. To number 1, let's read the number. Okay, number 1, to study, contemplate, and meditate. And we'll take a moment after each one. Practice 2, to leave my homeland. Practice 3, to rely on solitude. Practice 4, to let go of attachment to this lifetime. Practice 5, to give up negative friends. Practice 6, to rely on spiritual friends. And practice 7, we will chant 3 times. And again, doing our best to stay in touch with the meaning as we're chanting it as much as possible. So number 7 is to seek refuge in the 3 jewels. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The 3 jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. This is the way a Bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail, to seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail, to seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that's what we're going to explore today through the commentaries. But first, I don't know if, again, if people had a chance to read the contemplation that I posted. Let's start out by asking ourselves what we do when we get stressed out for whatever reason, when we're sick, when something bad happens, when we're feeling anxiety, whatever it is that interrupts our sense of well-being. Who do we turn to, or what do we turn to? And that's a question for each of us to answer for ourselves, because we all have things that we do to counteract the stresses of life. I would consider these, and some of the commentaries say this too, some kind of refuges. These are our sort of ordinary and sometimes counterproductive refuges. Some examples are opening the refrigerator, going for that pint of ice cream, or, drugs, if that's what we do, or alcohol, shopping, or venting. Venting, like we could turn to gossip, or we could turn to emotional lashing out at people, blame. Like, what do we do when we're stressed out? And what does it mean to seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Like, are those two things related at all? So if anybody has anything they'd like to say or share, along those lines, please do. And if not, that's fine. But just to be aware of that, and that's going to actually be the homework contemplation, and I'll post it, is to notice that, like, during the next week, notice, like, when stress arises and how you respond to it. And I'm going to be noticing that too. In fact, I pay a lot of attention to that. What do we do? What are our habitual patterns? This, I think, links back to verse 2, practice 2, to give up our habits and reactions. What are our habits and reactions? And how can the three refuges help us with that? How might they be a refuge for us in place of some of the things that we automatically turn to when we're having a hard time? One thing we're going to explore today is how do we actually take refuge? Like, what does it mean to take refuge? We know about the refuge prayer. You do that in the morning. Maybe if you follow the instructions on the card or that Rinpoche gave, when you took refuge, or whoever you took refuge with, generally they instruct us to chant the refuge prayer several times throughout the day. So that's a very formal way of doing it, but sometimes we're not totally connected to what we're doing. It can become a very rote thing. When we're actually under stress, how would we implement taking refuge in the Buddha instead of taking refuge in alcohol or screaming at somebody or collapsing in a heap, zoning out, turning on the TV, like whatever it is we do? How would we turn that into taking refuge in the Buddha? And is that an appropriate meaning? Is that really the meaning of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? This is, open to discussion. So I'm going to share with you, if I can find it. Yeah. I actually, so as Dan mentioned at the beginning of class, we had a service for a Sangha member, Scarlett Sams, who died a little while back, and for her 49th day, which was yesterday. And in preparation for that, we were going to chant the Shitro practice. And so in preparation for that, I was reviewing some teachings on Shitro from Siti Rinpoche and Lama Norla Rinpoche, so that I could say a few words about it for people who aren't so familiar. And in listening to Lama Norla Rinpoche's teaching, I never got to the Shitro part. But he had a very lovely section about refuge at the beginning of it. So, and I think it speaks directly to this question of how, what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in a practical sense? How do we do it? When do we do it? How do we do it? So I'm going to actually read a short section of that teaching. So again, this is from Lama Norla Rinpoche, 1994, teaching the practice of the peaceful and wrathful deities. So he says, well, he starts out saying, today Lama will give the explanation on the practice of the peaceful and wrathful deities. And then, as far as I can tell, he never actually does, but it may be, you know, a lot later. I think I've been through two of three tapes. And he goes on to say, whether one is listening to the Dharma or putting into practice or meditating, it's very important to generate the enlightened attitude. The Buddha said that while practicing the Dharma, there are three things that are most important. And again, we're not going to go into the three things. In fact, I'm not sure he did. He probably did by the end. But he spent a lot of time on the first one. These are called the three genuine aspects of practice. And they're part of every practice we do that makes it an authentic Buddhist practice. And the first one is, as we know, generating refuge, taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. And we do that like we did at the beginning of this class through our refuge and bodhicitta prayer. So he says, and then he launches into some thoughts about the benefits of refuge and how we can do that in our regular lives, not just at the beginning of a practice. So he says, taking refuge prevents one from having obstacles in one's Dharma practice. Generating the vast attitude of bodhicitta enables one's Dharma practice to be vastly effective and able to benefit infinite sentient beings. So that's why we do it at the beginning of a practice, to make our practice be effective without obstacles and to make it vastly effective, to increase its scope. But then he goes on to say, so it's not that we only need to take refuge when we're practicing during our sessions, but immediately upon waking up in the morning, if we take refuge, it prevents obstacles during the day or to anything we do during the day, both inner and outer obstacles. So beginning of the day, he suggests, when we first wake up, and Kala Rinpoche has said this too, that we should start our day with refuge in bodhicitta upon first waking up, and it will prevent obstacles. If we keep in mind that everything that is composite is impermanent, going for refuge to the Lama and Three Jewels and reciting the refuge prayer, this is being a Buddhist, remembering impermanence and taking refuge. Also, if we take refuge at night before we go to sleep, no harm can come to us while sleeping, and we will not have bad dreams. So beginning of the day and right before we go to sleep are good times to remember the refuge. And even if you don't feel that you want to recite the formal prayer at that time, just to remember you're surrounded by refuges all the time, and they're supporting your Dharma activity. And as a Dharma practitioner, they're helping you. I think it's a very powerful thing. So he says also, wherever we go, before we take a trip, before we set out, if we recite the refuge prayer, no obstacles will come on the way. So taking refuge is very important, the most important aspect of the Buddhist path. And here we see it in the 37 practices as the very first step onto the path. This is the bridge between the preliminary practices and actually being on the path, is taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. He says, the most important of all vows is the vow of refuge, because in order to receive the Bodhisattva vow, one first needs to have taken refuge or to take any empowerments. In the Vajrayana, you first have to have refuge. What's really important about the refuge prayer and the refuge vow is that it is able to purify negative actions and obscurations that we have accumulated previously. So even if we're doing Dorje Semple, we can remember that even through taking refuge, reciting the refuge prayer and remembering the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we're actually purifying all of our previous negative karma. And I believe that this is true. I take this very literally. Also, by taking refuge, any infractions or problems, such as if we've broken vows or commitments, the refuge vow has the ability to restore or to purify them. So if you feel that you have made some kind of a transgression in your, you know, your personal commitments, then you could simply take refuge according to this teaching. Also, for the future, it has the ability to prevent us from being born in the lower realms. Or if we take the lower realms somewhat figuratively, for example, as psychological states, the way that Trungpa Rinpoche has explained them, remembering refuge can actually help us from falling into those negative mental states and emotional states, the anger of the hell realms, the neediness of and greed of the hungry ghost realm, the fear and ignorance of the animal realm, and so forth. So we basically, to me, this suggests we want to keep refuge in mind as continuously as we possibly can. And he says, if we make a practice of taking refuge when we're happy and things are good, then when we are sick or have problems, we'll automatically look to refuge to help us. This is an example of the qualities of the three jewels and their power if we pray to them. And we're going to learn and you probably already read in Dingo Chensei's commentary that for refuge to be effective, we have to have faith that it is going to be effective. We've learned that in modern medicine. You know, if you believe that a medication is going to cure you or help you, then even if it's a placebo, most people actually get the effect or some of the effect. So like our own mental state, our own belief system is crucial to how much progress we make or what happens to us. I'm also going to skip ahead to just one short passage where Lama Norla Rinpoche tells us how to take refuge within the context of practice. And I think not only within the context of practice, but we can call upon, like he's talking about when we're doing Chinrezi or Tara or Medicine Buddha or whatever practice we take, like all of those include refuge. How do you visualize? What do you do when you're taking refuge within a specific practice? And I think because we call upon Chinrezi and we call upon Tara and Medicine Buddha in our daily lives as well, at least certainly I do, that we can also apply this at those times. Like if you're in some kind of trouble or experiencing some kind of fear and you call upon Tara and you do Tara's mantra, green Tara's mantra, then you could visualize in this way that Lama Norla Rinpoche is describing. And I think it makes it more powerful than just words. So he says, refuge means that one visualizes the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha and the appropriate deity, Chinrezi, Tara, Medicine Buddha, anyone else, that we are going to meditate on in front of us. So we visualize Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in front of us. And with, you know, you could visualize the refuge tree. We usually all are very used to that one. And visualize Chinrezi if that's the practice we're doing or the deity we're calling upon and so forth. And we take refuge with them to benefit all sentient beings. And now the scope of it is not just for that moment either. He says, every time we take refuge, we're taking refuge from today until we attain perfect enlightenment. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge until awakening. So it's a very vast scope of refuge. We're not off the hook when we die in this life. We're continuing our refuge. That's our aspiration. From today until attaining perfect enlightenment, and we seek refuge, we seek protection now. When we take refuge, we seek protection now in this moment, throughout this whole life, in our future lives, and in the bardo. So those are some things that Lama Norla Rinpoche had to say about refuge that I found very helpful and answers the question. So the stress hits, like the thing happens, you know, we fall ill or something bad happens, we get some bad news, whatever it is. Instead of turning to the ice cream, and I'm always going to use ice cream as the example, I guess, instead of turning to the ice cream, even if we turn to the ice cream afterwards, we could take refuge first. And that's what I try to do. I try to remember either awareness, like resting in awareness, or which is a refuge. That we're going to learn is the ultimate refuge, is our own mind. I see Deidre nodding. but if you take that moment, if we can train ourselves, like we're developing a new habit here, like, so we broke all our habits in verse 2, practice 2, like they're all gone. But it's not like we're leaving a vacuum of habits. We're developing positive, constructive habits. And one of them is, when stress strikes, don't turn to the ice cream first. Turn to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha first. Like, just remember, you could say the prayer, or you could do it, you know, it's still taking refuge if you call upon Tara or just spontaneously start reciting her mantra. That's refuge. You are taking refuge in that moment in Tara. Or if you see someone suffering and, it, you know, it just hits your heart and you just want to do something for them, you can call upon refuge. Maybe it's on TV and you can't do a thing. You know, it's miles away in Charlottesville and you can't do a thing, like, for that immediate situation. I'm pretty close to Charlottesville, but still, you know, a little while on the road. We might call on Shinrezi to relieve their suffering. And that's refuge. And we can remember, like in the refuge tree, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are always present, like fully present. The three jewels and the three roots, always present in the refuge tree. So even if we're only thinking of Tara, they're all present, and Tara embodies them all. So when we seek refuge in Tara through saying her mantra, visualizing her, she embodies all the refuges, and that is a way of taking refuge. So this is a practical way we can turn to refuge instead of ice cream. So anybody have anything to say before I open the books? So we're going to look at Dingo Chensei Rinpoche. I thought his commentary on this was very helpful and very inclusive. And as Anne mentioned, here we even have the three kayas again. We keep running into the three kayas. So one of the things I love about this commentary is that it's just full of teachings about every foundational topic in Buddhism. So in verse 7 on refuge, we get the three kayas reviewed for us. So I'm going to start reading at the beginning. It's on page 79. I'm just going to read a few passages, and I have a couple of other things to pull in, but mostly we're going to be talking about Dingo Chensei Rinpoche's commentary today. So he starts the same way I started. I'm sure I was inspired by him, with a review of the preliminary practices up to now. He says, the previous six verses have explained the preliminaries for developing bodhicitta. So that's expressed in a different way than I've expressed it. I always say the preliminaries for traveling the path, but it's really the path is how we develop bodhicitta, and Gampopa expresses it the same way. Almost all of his book is like how to become a bodhisattva, a true bodhisattva. So to become a true bodhisattva, which is our aspiration, we have to do all of these preliminary practices. So he says, and he does a quick, very elegant review of all the practices. You are aware now of the importance and the rarity of the human life you now have, and you realize the stark immediacy of death. You feel a great disillusionment with this world and have decided to rid yourself of distracting conditions and misleading influences, and to try to tame your mind according to the instructions of an authentic teacher. Now you are ready to cross the threshold of the Dharma and take refuge in the three jewels. People naturally search for refuge or for someone or something to protect them from sorrow and torment. Some people turn to the powerful with the hope of achieving wealth, pleasure, and influence. Others seek protection through natural forces such as the stars or the mountains. Some seek aid through the power of spirits, but none of these mistaken objects of refuge are free from ignorance and samsara, and they therefore cannot provide ultimate refuge. They may provide some very fleeting relief,
but they cannot provide real refuge. Their compassion, if they have any, do we know any billionaires who have compassion? We do, actually. But what can they do for us? Their compassion, if they have any, is partial and limited. We're not even on their radar, except in some very general sense that we fall into some demographic that they're helping. But they can't help us when we're in despair about something that's happening to us right now. So he says, true refuge can only be provided by something that is in itself totally free. Free from the bonds of samsara and free from the limited peace of a one-sided nirvana. So that's that's a different path. That's what he's talking here about, not the Mahayana path, where we're seeking our own individual liberation. And according to the scriptures, there are beings who end up in those places. Those are the form and formless realms of samsara, where you're like in meditative tranquility all the time, but you didn't develop the compassion of the Mahayana, so you can't get to full Buddhahood. And it's said, I can't remember what text it's in. It's in like one of the practices we chant in retreat. It's described very beautifully, but like it's said that it's actually probably in the first chapter of the Jewel Ornament on Buddha Nature, where he talks about the five families, the five categories of how far you are along towards realizing your Buddha nature. And he says that for beings who've gotten into that state where they've achieved partial awakening, but they're stuck, the Buddha reaches out and touches them with light. And then they realize that they didn't get all the way yet. And then they continue their path. So that's the one-sided nirvana. So samsara, like to get into like a little terminology here, what's called the three realms of samsara, as opposed to the six realms. We all know what the six realms are, but there's something called the three realms also. And one of the things that the three realms can refer to is this setup. The six realms of samsara all fall within the first of the three realms, which is the desire realm. It's called the desire realm. And then for those who have transcended desire, there's the other two, the form and the formless realms. And those are just different degrees of realization, sort of beyond. You're beyond samsara, but you're not totally free yet. So that's the form and formless realms. So to be a true refuge, you have to be free from not only samsara, the desire realm, but also free from the limited peace of the form and formless realms, the one-sided nirvana. This quality of true refuge is to be found only in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, with their absolute wisdom, unbiased compassion, and unimpeded ability. So he's now, again, if anybody has anything to say, feel free to unmute yourself or let me know. He's now going to describe each of these three refuges, and we're just going to hit the highlights, because we all basically know what they are. And then we're going to talk about something that's not in this book, which is which of the refuges is ultimate. Because we've had, like what we talked about last week was when we find an authentic teacher or someone we think is an authentic teacher and it turns out that they have a failing, are they still our refuge? And that's like Gampopa describes that in great detail in a very helpful way, like, why that's not actually a problem. But to get back to what the three refuges are, he says the first of the three jewels is the Buddha. The qualities that characterize the Buddha can be seen in terms of three aspects or dimensions called kayas, literally bodies in Sanskrit. The Dharmakaya, which is the absolute body or the body of truth. The Sambhogakaya, which is the body of perfect endowment, literally the body of enjoyment. And the Nirmanakaya, the manifestation body, like the physical, what we think of as the physical body that you can touch. These three are all aspects of one essence. And so now he goes into a short explanation of the three kayas, which if you've read other things and studied other things about the three kayas, this may not say the same things. And remembering that he is a Nyingma teacher, primarily and not Kagyupa, and sometimes things are expressed differently. Not that this is not something you'd encounter in our lineage too, but it's not the typical way that we may have heard the Kayas described in. I'm going to read through this briefly, but then I want to turn to Ringu Tulku, who has a very, very helpful and clear explanation, description of the three Kayas in his book, Path to Buddhahood. So here, Dingo Chensei says, the Dharmakaya is the absolute, inconceivable, empty expanse of wisdom. So empty is the key word here. It corresponds, Dharmakaya corresponds to the realization of emptiness, the emptiness aspect of our, the totality of our mind, the nature of our mind. And so the Dharmakaya is like the Dharmakaya, the formless, not having any characteristics, empty aspect of the Buddha's realization is called the Dharmakaya, the body of truth. The enlightened wisdom of the enlightened wisdom mind of the Buddha is imbued with awareness, compassion, and ability. Beyond all conceptual elaboration, its expression is the five primordial wisdoms. The Sambhogakaya is the natural display of these five primordial wisdoms arising as the five certainties, the perfect teacher, the perfect teachings, the perfect time, the perfect place, and the perfect retinue. The Sambhogakaya remains by nature unchanging and unceasing throughout past, present, and future, beyond both growth and decline. So that's a little challenging to navigate, that description. These are called the five certainties, and we're not really going to try to get into them. It's referring, I think, based on my understanding of it, to teachings that are available only on the Sambhogakaya level. Like when you reach the Bodhisattva stages, when you really have, like, you first officially become a Bodhisattva when you realize emptiness, when you first realize emptiness. Like, it's not a continuous realization yet, because that's Buddhahood. But when you reach the stage where, when you're sitting in meditation, you see things the way they really are, that is the first bhumi. It's actually the third stage, called the path of seeing in the five paths. We're getting technical now, but if you have an orientation to these systems of description of the path, it's the third path. The path of seeing is the first bhumi, and that is seeing emptiness, like really seeing it directly. So when you reach that stage, and I'm not sure if it happens at the first bhumi or a little bit later, but there is a point at which, when you reach a certain level of realization, you can receive Sambhogakaya teachings directly. Like, you could get teachings directly from Buddhas in their Sambhogakaya form, which is the same as like Chinrezi's or Tara's form, like the body of light with all of the accoutrements. We're not there. We're not getting any Sambhoga, like, not that I know of. I don't know who here might be there, but it's not me. So we don't have to worry about the five certainties at this time. It's like a description of an ideal teaching on the Sambhogakaya level, which is not perceptible to us. We're stuck in the Nirmanakaya for now. So to get to the Nirmanakaya, so Sambhogakaya, I don't feel like we really covered it. It's the luminosity or clarity aspect of enlightenment. It's like there's something there. It's when there's something there, like in Dharmakaya, there's nothing there. It's completely unmanifested. It's the ultimate reality. But between that and the solid reality that we perceive is the Sambhogakaya. It's like sometimes described as like the level of energy, the level of emotions, the level of speech. Speech is somewhere between formless. It's not silence, but it's also not solid. Like, you cannot catch speech. Every single word I'm saying is gone as soon as I say it. You hear it. It was there, but where is it? It's not there, but yet you can't say it doesn't exist. That's the Sambhogakaya. It's the part of the nature of mind that is manifesting, but it not as a physical solid thing. So that's like a bridge to the Nirmanakaya. That's the between state. And Bokar Rinpoche teaches in, I think it's his book on Tara, Green Tara, which is a lovely book. He says that the Sambhoga, he says exactly that Sambhogakaya, which is where Tara manifests, like our visualization of Tara is Sambhogakaya. It's a bridge to help us get to the ultimate reality of the Dharmakaya, which is the without characteristics emptiness aspect of a reality. So then the Nirmanakaya, which is where we dwell and what we can perceive, Buddhists manifest as the Nirmanakaya according to the different needs and capacities of beings, and thus the Nirmanakaya appears in countless different forms. So the only way we could get teachings, like ordinary beings such as ourselves could get teachings, is if somebody, if some enlightened being embodies in a physical form. But the people with realization, beings with realization, don't need a Buddha. Like they can perceive the Buddha in Sambhogakaya form, not limited. You know, I mean, the Nirmanakaya form is a very limited thing. You know, they are born and they die just like regular beings. So that's the quick, I don't think we're going to get to the Ringu Tulku. I'm not sure if we need to, but if anybody wants to explore the three kayas further, feel that you don't really understand them, Path to Buddhahood is a very good book to have because it has a really, really good, helpful description. And I can put a reference on the in my post to where that is. And maybe in the post I can like sort of take a couple of sentences out of Ringu Tulku for each kaya. So it's important to remember that of these three aspects, it is only the Dharmakaya Buddha that is the ultimate refuge. And we're going to, Gampopa is going to help us understand that. But to actualize the Dharmakaya refuge, the ultimate refuge, we have to rely on the teachings given by the Nirmanakaya Buddha. So Nirmanakaya Buddha is our first, like, way, our initial foundational way to relate to the teachings, to the Buddha. And then through our practice at this level of embodiment, we can progress through the Sambhogakaya all the way to ultimate reality. Okay, so I'm skipping ahead. Some things about the teachings and so forth. But let's just look at the three jewels right now because we don't have a lot of time left. And I do want to get to Gampopa. The second of the three jewels, and I'm on page 81 now, the second of the three jewels is the Dharma, which is the teachings that the Buddha gave on how the enlightenment that he had realized can be attained through practice. And so then it describes like the three baskets and the three turnings of the wheel. And I'm not going to go into that right now, but you can read the commentary for more detail on that. And then the third of the refuges is the Sangha, which here is described as the community of the Buddha's followers. Often, and this is a bit more classical, it just referred to ordained Sangha, like really the level of teachers and ordained Sangha. But I think most people, including teachers, now present it as anybody who follows the path. It's our Dharma community. It's our spiritual friends. It includes the 8 great bodhisattvas, the 16 arhats, the 7... So these are people, we can't even meet them. Like, a lot of our Sangha, we don't even know because they're beyond our perception. The 8 great bodhisattvas, they're there. We take refuge in them all the time. They're depicted in the refuge tree, but we're not going to meet them face to face because we can't perceive the Sambhogakaya level on which they exist. The 16 arhats, the 7 patriarchs that succeeded the Buddha, and all those who teach the Buddha's teachings, along with those who practice them. So we're all included in this group, the Sangha. We're taking refuge in ourselves and our spiritual friends and buddies. Okay, so what I'm going to look at now, I thought like Patrick and Marilyn might be here, and I think that question might have come up. But what does it mean to take refuge in our teachers if they turn out to be sort of ordinary beings with human failings, as, you know, we sometimes experience? So I turned to, let me see what the page number is. I turned to Ornament of Precious Liberation, Gampopa's compendium here, for that, because I remembered he addressed it. And it's on page 100 if you have this translation. 100. All right, so he says, I was going to read some of his very beautiful verses that he quotes on, like, why we don't take refuge in worldly refuges. But if you have Ornament of Precious Liberation, or one of the translations called the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, then you can read it. Taking Refuge is a very helpful chapter to read in that book. This would be a good time to read it if you haven't read it lately. But then he says, the ultimate source of refuge in terms of ultimate essence is the Buddha alone. So the Buddha is an ultimate refuge, and Dharma and Sangha are relative refuges. It's only the Buddha upon which we can completely 100% rely. He says, why is it that the Dharma and the Sangha are not a lasting source of refuge? Of the two types of Dharma, the Dharma as teachings, being a collection of terms and an assembly of letters, books, papers, YouTube videos, it is something to be abandoned once it has served its purpose, just as you would abandon a vehicle once the journey is done. You don't take the taxi cab with you into the Metropolitan Opera. Hence, it is not a lasting refuge. We only need the Dharma for as long as we need it, and then we're done with it. We can't say that of the Buddha. The Buddha always is with us. You know, there's the external Buddha. You would never need to walk away from the Buddha as refuge. And also, the Buddha is there to teach you that the Buddha is also internal. You know, the ultimate refuge. Ken McLeod talks more about this. I don't know if we'll get to that today, about ultimate refuge being really our own awareness, our own realized awareness, which is the same awareness that the Buddha embodies. So that's the Dharma's not a lasting refuge. It's books, it's papers, it's videos, it's, you know, it's we don't need it all the time. As for the Sangha, they themselves take refuge in the Buddha. So they can't be the ultimate refuge. They take refuge in the Buddha through fear of samsara. So our teachers, however realized they are, they still are within samsara. They still need protection from samsara. They take refuge in the Buddha. So therefore, they cannot constitute a supreme and lasting refuge. So then he says, well, then does this not contradict what has been said above about the three refuges, that we should take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha? The latter, he says, originated as a skillful means. The Dharma and the Sangha, it's not that they're not refuges, but they're just relative refuges. And they were created by the Buddha as a skillful means for guiding those who are training as Buddhists. So just like the ultimate Kaya is the Dharma Kaya, and the other two Kayas are considered relative Kayas, the Buddha is the ultimate refuge, the only perfect, complete, lasting refuge. And the other ones are meant as support. They help us. So if we run into a situation where we question the Sangha, like, how can this be a refuge for me? Then we remember it's an imperfect refuge. It's not a complete refuge. And so it doesn't destroy the whole concept of refuge if, you know, if the Sangha in some way disappoints us. So a little bit more from Dingo Chenzi's commentary. We have about 15 minutes left, and there will be time for comments and sharing. I wanted to look at what he says about faith on page 84. This is so important, and it's also important to the concerns that we talked about last week. So on 84, he says, faith is the prerequisite for refuge. And its very essence. So faith is the essence of refuge. Without faith, we don't really have refuge. Taking refuge does not just mean reciting a refuge prayer. But again, that doesn't mean we don't recite the refuge prayer, that it's not helpful. It's just relative. It's a support for the real refuge, which is our faith, our heartfelt belief that the Buddha showed the true path, and that the Dharma is the true path, and that those who help us follow the path are true guides. It must come, faith must come from the depth of your heart, from the marrow of your bones. If you have that complete confidence in the three jewels, their blessings will always be present in you, like the sun and the moon being instantly reflected in clear, still water. It's a very beautiful image. If we have faith in them, they're there. It's like, it's called the ring and the hook. And I believe, I can't remember which one is which, but you know, you have to have the ring of like the Buddha being there, the Buddha's realization being there, the Buddha's compassion for us being there. But if we don't have the hook to hook into it, which is faith, we'll never make the connection. So we have to make the connection through our own belief, confidence, and faith. And so I really think that the four kinds of faith, they're usually in the Kagyu lineage. I don't know if this is a Nyingma thing that he lists four kinds of faith, or just if most of the lists that I see, such as in Gampopa in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, if we only recognize three kinds of faith. But you know, we'll do the four today, but the first three are the ones that we usually see explained. I think this is very, very important to understand, and it speaks directly to one of the things we discussed last week, which is, it's the first reliance. It relates directly to the first reliance. And so, silent pop quiz, what is the first reliance? Just take a moment and see if you can remember. So the first reliance taught by the Buddha is rely on the Dharma, not the teacher, not the individual person. And so what that means is that we get teachings from the teacher, we get instruction from the teacher, which is the Dharma, but we have to then carry the ball. We have to carry the ball down the field ourselves. You know, he passes it to us, but we got to carry it through our own practice. And that's what the three levels of faith is about. We can't stay at the first level. If we stay at the first level, we're completely immature, unrealized practitioner. And if the thing that we're inspired by turns out to be faulty in some way, we have nothing. We got nothing left. So, you know, if we and the teacher are still together holding the ball and we didn't like take it on our own, then if the teacher goes away, the ball falls down. That's probably a bad analogy, but I love analogies. So again, on page 84, Dingo Chense gives a description of the four kinds of faith, or the four levels of faith. And I think it works that way, that we come in at the first level, and then through our own hard work of practice, the other two levels of faith manifest. And that is the maturing of a Dharma practitioner. So he says, as faith develops, four successive levels of faith can be distinguished. When you meet a teacher, hear the Dharma for the first time, learn about the extraordinary qualities of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, or read the life stories of great masters of the past, a vivid feeling of joy arises in your mind as you discover that there are such beings. This is the first kind of faith. And he calls it vivid faith here. I call it the faith of inspiration. We are inspired by the Dharma, or we are inspired by the teacher, or we are inspired by a statue of the Buddha, a tanka, just knowing. Like when I first met Amenorla Rinpoche and other teachers, I could just see that they had something that was just amazing, and I didn't have it. And that's what drew me into the Dharma. I want to be like that. I want to have that. So that's the faith of inspiration. If we never move beyond that, then we're in trouble if that disappears. So what's the next level? When thinking of the great masters or your teacher or the Dharma fills you with a deep longing to know more, to receive more teachings from them, to develop spiritual qualities yourself, to become like them, this is the second kind of faith. Here he calls it eager faith. There's a lot of translations of it out there. I call it the faith of aspiration. And I didn't make these translations up. It's the one I picked. So inspiration, you see it, you want to be like it. aspiration, you realize you can be like it and you get to work. Like, what do I have to do to embody the same thing? What do I have to do to recognize myself as the three kayas? Third level of faith, as you reflect on the teachings, practice, and as you reflect on the teachings, practice and assimilate them, you develop complete confidence in their truth and in the Buddha's boundless perfection. This exactly echoes the third practice of a bodhisattva, to rely on solitude. What happens when we rely on solitude? In the moment, I'm not going to come up with the verse, but But anyway, it's there. It's like the whole thing unfolding. Like, we disengage ourselves from our activities and we disengage ourselves from distractions. Our Dharma practice grows to fill the space. From that awareness, knowing Rigpa, whatever it does, clarifies. And what happens, what's the third piece of that sequence is that confidence, certainty in truth of Dharma dawns and thrives. Certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. So that's exactly what he's saying here. The more we immerse ourselves in the teachings through our own study, reflection, and practice, the more confidence we develop in the truth of the teachings and in the Buddha's boundless perfection. I'm going to skip that part. At this stage, you are free from doubt. This is the third kind of faith, confident faith. And at that point, it doesn't matter whether the first kind of faith holds up 100%. You know, your teacher can disappoint you, but you have confidence in the Dharma itself. And then in the fourth level, which we don't see in most of our Kagyu lists, he says, when your confidence is so well established that it can never waver, even at the cost of your life, even if someone was threatening to chop off your head with a sword, it wouldn't affect your faith in the Buddha, your confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This is the fourth kind of faith, irreversible faith. So to take refuge, he says, to take refuge in a genuine way, you should have these four kinds of faith, especially irreversible faith. We're working up to that. Some of us are still mostly operating on faith of inspiration. It depends on how much practice you do. So you want to do the practice. And again, that's the first verse. The first practice of a bodhisattva is study, contemplate, and meditate. That is Dharma practice. That is what we need to do to mature as Dharma practitioners. So then he explains what we need to do to keep the refuge vow. I think we all know that, but you can read it in the commentary. And then he says on page 86, remember the three jewels in all your activities throughout the day, no matter whether you are happy or sad. If you see a beautiful landscape, flowers, or anything wonderful and inspiring, offer it mentally to the three jewels. So this is mindfulness. You know, here's basic mindfulness. Remember, the more we can remember throughout the day that the refuges are with us and that that is our protection, and that we can, when we run across a beautiful sunset or whatever it is, we can think we offer it to them. This is very, very powerful practice to do. When good circumstances or events arise, see them as the blessing and kindness of the three jewels. Regard all sicknesses and obstacles without complaint as blessings in disguise that will enable you to purify your past negative karma. Study this commentary. This is fabulous advice. When confronted with great danger or with terrifying situations, call upon the three jewels for assistance. And again, you can think of the Buddha or you could think of Tara. Same thing, like whatever feels like the most powerful way for you to relate to the refuges in that moment when you're terrified, when you're in danger. Call upon that. That is refuge. At that very moment, the blessings of the three jewels will grant you protection. When you practice taking refuge in this manner, refuge will become an inherent part of your stream of consciousness. Take refuge from the core of your heart for the sake of all beings from now until they all attain enlightenment. This is the true way of a bodhisattva. And that is the end of Dingo Chenpo's commentary. I'm just going to say about Ken's commentary, because we're pretty much out of time. I will open it for comments. Not that it wasn't always open, but I'll formally open it. He talks about, as I did at the beginning, and as Dingo Shensei mentioned at the beginning too, you know, think about what we take refuge in already. That's what's referred to here, among other things, as the worldly deities. They can't help us. Ice cream cannot help us, really. It can make us feel better for 5 minutes until we start to feel queasy. But it's not a refuge. So as we go through this week, moment to moment, as much as you can, be mindful and notice when you need refuge and when you're looking for refuge, when you're looking for relief, when you're looking for protection, and turn to the three jewels. And then do whatever else you need to do. If you have to turn on the TV, fine. But take refuge in the three jewels first, and you will develop that habit and embody what Dingo Chensei described at the end of the commentary. Let me see if there's anything else. I think that's it. Okay, so anybody have anything to say? I'm going to unmute everybody for a minute before we do our prayers. Okay, you're all unmuted. If anybody has anything to say. Yes, John.
Yeah, I was a little uncertain or unclear about the one-sided nirvana, the meaning of that, and if you can help me understand that.
It means that you've achieved peace of mind through your practice. You've achieved your personal peace of mind. You could rest in meditation for 100 years, and they do that. Like, there's stories of, you know, the meditators whose hair grows and melts them and their fingernails grow, but they sit in meditation and they never have to come out because they freed themselves from the suffering and the concerns of samsara. But they didn't look at other beings yet and realize that they still have work to do to free other beings from samsara. They only did half their job. So that's one-sided nirvana. It's nirvana for yourself alone.
So is that like an arhat?
Yeah, it's an arhat. It's exactly what it is. It's an arm. Okay, anybody else got anything? Okay. All right, so before we do our prayer, so actually I'm just going to post that. Never mind. That's it. All right, I guess we can do our prayer and be on time. Again, if anybody wants to linger, let me know. I mean, we don't need to linger if nobody has anything they want to discuss. But if you do, let me know and I'll stay for a few minutes. And otherwise, I'll end the meeting for everybody. So dedicating our meditation. So I talked at the beginning, Rinpoche, Lama Rinpoche and his Shitro teaching that was about refuge, talked about the three aspects of genuine practice. And that is to begin by taking refuge and generating bodhicitta, then to do the main practice. And then the third piece of it that you need to make it authentic practice is dedication of merit. So dedicating any benefit from this class to the enlightenment of all beings in all six realms, all three realms in all six realms. This merit may it win omniscient, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zanko, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate all practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Let's bring our mind to rest just for a moment.